1973.
Well, welcome back to the program on this extra long daylight saving special edition of the program. The number is still the same, 131873. Great to have your company. As promised on yesterday's program, I said out of the 5 o'clock news we'd be speaking with a very special guest, and indeed I have him on the line right now. Professor David Flint is from the Can Do organisation. Of course, you would recognise David from a whole lot of other experiences in life, including his role with the Australian Monarchy Movement, as well as being on the board of ACMA, I believe, at some point, among other things. But this morning, I want to discuss three primary issues with David, and of course, it may go off other avenues as well, because these are issues that I know a lot of people are concerned about, a lot of people are talking about. Firstly, the Republic, we'll look at that briefly, but then we'll get into some of the meaty stuff that we've been doing of late with the likes of Julia Patrick, Dr. Amy McGrath, Dr. Lucy Sullivan and others. And that is to do with the challenges to private property in this country, challenges to the efficiency and the democratic nature of the Australian parliamentary democracy, issues to do with the United Nations and their influence over us, and also, if we get time, we'll touch on the rather unspoken about but overt issue of vote fraud in Australia. But without further ado, it's a very good morning to Professor David Flint. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Michael.
Great to have you on the program. Thank you for your time at this early point of the morning.
Not at all.
Now, yesterday I was reading an article, I think it was in the Fairfax Press, surprise, surprise, talking about Malcolm Turnbull's return to the discussion to do with the Republic. So before we get into some of the deeper things that we'll talk about this morning and dedicate much time to this morning, I note that Malcolm Turnbull is going to be having a conversation about our Australian identity with the former Labor WA leader Jeff Gallop AC. Do the Republicans have much to offer in regard to a conversation about our national identity?
Not at all. They've been going for so long, and they seem to retreat further and further. In 1999, they at least had a model. Since 1999, they don't even have a model, and they've receded back in the polls. The support for a republic, which probably was at its highest before the 1999 referendum, has receded across the polls and over time, so much so that it's now down in the low 30s, and that's support for a vague, undefined republic. People who know much about constitutional matters know that Australia is already a republic. We're a crowned republic, and what is being offered is something which would take away the crown. You see, the people who run the country, the power brokers in the parties and the elites, don't like the crown because they can't control it. And it worries them, and what they offered in 1999 was something which would have increased the power of the Prime Minister and the political parties. It would have been the only republic in recorded history in which it would have been easier for the Prime Minister to sack the President than his cook. It was quite extraordinary.
Just say that again. It would have been easier for the Prime Minister.
For the Prime Minister to sack the President than his cook or his driver. The extraordinary thing is that the Prime Minister could sack the President without notice, without reason, and without appeal.
You see, the reason I ask you about this, other than, of course, you've been one of the forerunners for some time trying to defend the Constitution that we have and the arrangements therein, is that they're charging up to $1,500 for a table of 10 to discuss something that, in my thinking anyway, the Republicans don't really have much of a claim on. Because when they're talking about the Australian identity, surely anybody who's even half a scholar of history or reality would recognise that the monarchical links back to the crown in England is part of Australia's identity. Surely what they're discussing is trying to reinvent our identity.
Yes, the crown is the oldest institution in the country. And incidentally, talking about celebrity dinners, candlelit dinners, they were criticised a lot for that. When we had the Constitutional Convention, the ARM stayed at the five-star hotel. All of the constitutional, the monarchist delegation, the ACM, Australia's a Constitutional Monarchy, went out to a motel at Narrabunda. It showed the difference between the two organisations. Australia's a Constitutional Monarchy was always a grassroots organisation. We worked with a number of allies, and we had people there. We had Neville Bonner, the great Aboriginal senator. He gave the only speech at the convention, which led to a standing ovation. The Constitutional Monarchists were very much grassroots. The ARM was the one. They were the celebrities with a lot of money. They had the support of most of the politicians and of the media.
The arts community.
Yeah, certainly the arts community. They had vast amounts of money, and they thought that they were going to win, and they didn't, because the Australian people voted so strongly against them. Even with all of the media, even with the difficulties of the younger members of the royal family, we won nationally. In every state, and 72% of federal electorates. Mm. It was a landslide.
It was a wipeout.
Yes.
And good for Australia's situation that it was that way.
Well,
although they don't give up, do they? They just don't give up. It's like Chinese water torture with these people.
Yes. And I find it extraordinary that, Malcolm, where you have an election this year where the shadow cabinet should show unity. And he knows that Tony Abbott is a constitutional monarch. He was the first executive director of Australia as a constitutional monarchy.
Mm.
And yet he's gone off to go for this conversation at this function, and I find that extraordinary. And I think it's brand differentiation. He's demonstrating to the elites that he is somewhat different from the future Prime Minister.
Now, in a way, I suppose, Professor Flint, this flows into what we're about to talk about next, the body of the discussion this morning. But can I ask you your thoughts on this? What is the ethos, what is the ideology driving those, particularly the elite, and we've established that tends to be who's behind this, driving those who are pushing for an Australian Republic? A, they don't have a model defined. They don't really, in essence, know cohesively what they're talking about, but they all seem to be very keen on changing the status quo, influencing the Constitution as a result, changing the way Australians know their democratic process. What's at play here?
They are alienated completely from the rank and file, from the average Australian. The common sense, the good judgment and the decency of the Australian people go against them, and everything that they propose just about goes against what your station refers to as the pub test.
Mm.
And all of the, you know, what they've done, for example, over the years to the criminal justice system, which has moved away from the victim to the protection of the accused and then the criminal, keeping the juries in the dark, all that sort of thing.
Mm.
The way in which they've changed the laws in relation to property, which I gather we'll be talking about in a moment.
Yes.
All of these are significant changes, and they want to change the very basis, the nature of our Australian nation, the nation which so many pioneered and so many fought for, and they just don't like Australia. They hate Australia as it is, and they want to change it significantly.
It seems that many of them are internationalists to a large degree, and that flows us into the second major issue this morning, and that is the challenges now to private property in Australia for the sovereign people. Now, in an interview I did last week with Julia Patrick, which certainly got a big following, and it's available on a podcast from our website, she describes what is taking place as on a meta-narrative level as Fabian gradualism. She says this is the game plan, and she gives us the example of the National Wildlife Corridors Plan, basically from east to west, north to south, huge amounts of land, most of it prime agricultural productive land, being locked up so that, as she puts it, the Wollum sedge frog or the golden sun moth can multiply freely without intrusion by man. Now, I mean, that's all nice and cute and humorous, but there's a sinister message here, isn't there?
There is indeed. Lionel Murphy, who was the radical who changed so much of Australia when he was on the High Court, said that the exaltation of property rights over civic and political rights is a reflection of a past age. In other words, property rights were something of the past.
Mm.
And the Marxists have never liked property rights. And in fact, all this talk about human rights really raises the issue of property rights. The old Marxists used to want to take property. The new Marxists have learned that you don't need to take property. You just neutralize people's rights to property, and that's happening everywhere. Remember a few years ago, Peter Spencer?
Up the poll, yes.
He went up a poll, threatened a starvation to death, and that was because, by arrangement between the federal government, which, if it expropriates property, has to pay compensation, and the governor of New South Wales, his farm was declared a carbon sink for completely no use whatsoever. The federal government decided it needed to comply with the Kyoto Protocol, although it refused to sign it. This is the Howard government, mind
you. Yes, that's right, yes.
And his farm was declared a carbon sink, and it was completely useless for him, but no damages were being paid for it. This reflects what's happening, and it reflects the Agenda 21, and that is, it is to neutralise property, to turn it into wildernesses, to force us into high rises in the cities where there'll be little electricity and where we'll live rather primitive lives. And they want to take away the property rights of Australians. We see this, for example, in the environmental arrangements in relation to property in New South Wales. And then I was listening to an interview on the north coast up
right
near Ballina, where people have found that under the environmental plan, their property has been redesignated, and has been redesignated environmental one and environmental two. And what happens is, for example, when a farmer leaves a field fallow one year, he finds that when he wants to go back to what it originally was, whatever he was farming beforehand,
yeah,
he has to go to the local council and put in a development application, which is an enormously onerous exercise and very expensive.
A DA?
Yes.
As if somebody in Sydney were putting an extension, a conservatory onto a house, he's got to do this with his farm to rotate
That's
the
right.
crops.
So these enormous restrictions are being put, increasing restrictions so that you can't touch vegetation on your land. All sorts of things happen so that they neutralise the use of the land so it becomes worthless to you and very expensive to run, and you very easily get into trouble.
So people just throw their hands up, don't they, Professor Flint, and say, look, I don't want to leave the farm. It's been in the generations for years, but I just can't handle this. This is all too much. It's too expensive. It's too cumbersome. I'm moving. I'm selling.
That's right. Two exceptions are made, one of which is native title, which is a form of collectivist title. Instead of giving the Aboriginal people individual title, they give them Soviet-style collectivist title.
Like an indigenous kibbutz.
Yes, doesn't help anybody. And naturally, of course, those people aren't finding anything good from that, except for a few people who are making a lot of money from it.
Mm.
And then that's just one aspect, and the other is to take away or to put so many restrictions on people's title that they have to move away from it. And they do that in pursuance, as we know, of an international agenda, Agenda 21, which applies particularly through the municipal and shire corporations who apply it.
I think my council, Parramatta, is part of the signatory of that.
Yes, and at the same time, they have sealed up vast parts of the state in so-called national parks, where they don't maintain the park properly. They have no money. They don't put any money aside to maintain it, and they're against clearing or having preparatory fires, to precautionary fires,
yes,
clear them out. And so bushfires start in those areas, they spread across into private land, and it's very useful to blame the climate for that, as though bushfires never happened in Australia. They have policies of having no dams, so that it becomes very difficult to make areas, for example, in the north, useful. When the Rudd government got in, they removed the people on the Howard government committee to investigate the building of dams in the north, and they appointed people who were all opposed to dams, and they came down with the conclusion that there was no point, there wasn't sufficient water in the north to build dams, although there's an enormous amount of water up there, and it would in fact be an excellent place to build up a food bowl for Asia.
Well, they seem to be, don't they, the only people that think there isn't enough water in the north, because even Rupert Murdoch's decided he's going to put a bit of coin up there.
Yes.
As the imminent development occurs. Are we seeing a bit of a clash of ideologies here, Professor Flint, between those who continue to want to grow the economy and those from the Fabian socialist left, as a collective term, UN-driven types, that see humanity as a threat to the environment and want to curtail its expansion at anywhere possible.
That's very much so. What we're seeing is an alliance or an axis between the power brokers of the parties on the one side and the elites who have this international agenda. Where they make an exception is in relation to the parts where they can very quickly ravage the land and make an enormous amount of money. For example, putting CSG mining onto prime agricultural land. That seems to be done without any regard for the environment, without checking anything, and using vast amounts of water for which farmers would have to pay if they were to even use a small proportion of the amount. So you get a very peculiar situation. It all flows from the way the country has been run for some time, that is, the way in which the power brokers now control the major parties.
Yes, explain a bit of this, because you've got a book coming out as well, I know, that covers some of this. But explain for the listeners, and indeed for myself, Professor Flynn, how the Australian electoral system has morphed away from a very open, democratic, traditional system to something that is much more closeted and, in essence, much more secretive.
What seems to be the most likely indicator of success in human development are the institutions which societies have. And we had superb institutions which we inherited from the British, and then we began to build our own, particularly in the period leading up to Federation. We were a particularly democratic society, and in 1893 at Corowa, we resolved, and it was at a popular conference, a people's conference, which was adopted by the politicians, that we would have a convention, a national convention, which would be elected, that when they came to develop a constitution, this would be put to the people. It wouldn't just be put to the parliaments. It wouldn't just go to London. The Australian people themselves would choose it. Mm. So we had a very democratic situation, and that came from other things which we developed, for example, the secret ballot and then votes for women, which came extraordinarily quickly in Australia, and when the Federation was formed, within a year of the Federation. So we had a very, very democratic institutions, and any change to the Constitution had to be approved by the people. The party system wasn't highly developed, but gradually over the years, the two-party system has firmed. And they've grabbed a lot of power, and the parties have not been democratic. They've been run by power brokers. About 100 years ago in America, they realized that you couldn't have things run just by power brokers. You had to break that, and they gradually introduced primaries.
The primary system, yeah.
Yes, where people, the supporters of the parties, Democrats and Republicans, themselves chose their candidates in elections, which isn't the situation now. Your candidates are basically chosen in pre-selections for their loyalty to a particular power broker, not for their merit as a candidate.
And look at the quality of candidate we're getting in some respects on both sides of the
House. Yes, particularly Labor, but also on the other side. Some people slip through always. Whatever the system is, somebody gets through. They got through with the rotten boroughs in England, and you do get quality that way. But we do have a situation which in some ways resembles the rotten boroughs. Now, they've grabbed an enormous amount of power. For example, the public funding of elections, the way in which the preferences for the Senate are secret, virtually secret, very difficult to get to know what they are, and they do secret deals, and you wouldn't have the foggiest idea when you vote above the line where your votes are going.
Indeed. Okay, well, if you could just hold on there one moment, Professor Flint, we'll go to the 5:30 news. And then off the back of that, we'll get into part two of this, if that's okay. We'll look at particularly the issue of vote fraud, but also toward the end of that chat, let's try to get in something about citizen-initiated referenda as well. Of course, if you want to give us a call, everybody, you can. 131873, the open line is open. Purcell, this Sunday morning, the 7th of April 2013. The number is 131873. We're speaking with Professor David Flint. And, David, if we could, just at this point, I want us to move the conversation toward looking at the issue of vote fraud particularly. And it was, wasn't it, most pronounced, I guess, in the contemporary era in the 1980s, wasn't it?
They decided in the 80s, Labor decided that they had to make it easier to vote. Though nobody was complaining that it was difficult to vote. And what they've done is, instead of our voting in our subdivision, you can vote anywhere in your electorate. They've increased declaration voting, which gives them enormous power, and I'll come to that in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, there's been no attempt to improve the identity at the time you vote. We now have a system whereby when you take a small amount of money out of your account, that's then available in any ATM in the country. Any ATM knows that you've already taken money out.
Well, I'm just reading off your I'm reading off your CanDo website as we speak now, and you, here on the petition to do with stop electoral fraud, it says at the top, it's easier to vote now than it is to collect a registered parcel valued at a few dollars at the post office.
Exactly, yes, and you have to go and produce some identity. It's absolutely ridiculous. And the other thing, of course, which probably opens up more fraud, is the registrations.
Mm.
Now, there's a tsunami of registrations as soon as the formal notice is given. That floods in, and because of heaven knows why, because of the High Court, the judges who decide that they'll make the law and the Constitution will mean what they say it means. You might remember before the 2010 election,
there was the get-up situation.
Yes, and there were two people petitioning who were in breach of the law. They couldn't be bothered to, one couldn't be bothered to register in time, and the other one couldn't be bothered to give his change of address. But they were rushed through the High Court, and the decision was announced before the election, where the High Court rewrote the Constitution, because it was obvious under the Constitution that it was for the Parliament to decide when the rolls would close. The High Court says no, the Constitution somewhere says when the rolls are to close. You could turn the Constitution inside out to find that out. It's a matter for the Parliament.
Mm.
The High Court, by a 4-3 decision, we weren't told it was a 4-3 decision, and they took about 5 months to actually write their reasons, which suggested was that they came to their conclusion and wrote their reasons afterwards. It was absolutely outrageous, one of the worst decisions of the High Court. And it just shows you the dangers of letting judges decide what the Constitution is and decide what the law is, because they take these decisions, which are far beyond anything that they should. Well, that they stopped Howard's reform. John Howard could have, when he had the majority in both houses, done something about cleaning up.
Yes. Why didn't he?
He's more interested in work choices, I suppose.
Yes, I suppose fight one battle at a time. But
and a lot of people don't believe. They accept the argument that there isn't electoral fraud.
But there's been evidence, hasn't there, over decades now, of golf courses voting one particular way. It always tends to go one way, and we won't mention which way that is. People can determine that for themselves. But vacant plots of land, golf courses, rivers, lakes, they even dead people, they tend to be loyal to one particular party, don't they?
Well, Gough Whitlam is alleged to have said to Joe Reardon when he lost Philip, he said, "Comrade, how could you be so extraordinarily negligent? You have three cemeteries in your electorate."
Says it all, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The amount of fraud is high, and of course now we have the Electoral Commission says it's not automatic enrolment, but it is. People are found to be on the motor registry, and they're not on the roll. A notice is sent to them at whatever address they had, or at least we're told this is how it's going to work.
And of course, to be on the motor registry, I don't believe you have to be a citizen.
No. So people are being added to the roll, and if they don't say this is wrong and I'm not a citizen, for example, they're going to be put on the rolls. And we don't know how much fraud there will be in this, because I wouldn't be surprised if there are people who are putting people on the roll on other registries to get them onto the roll.
Now, exactly. Now, why I've said often, and this probably, I can't probably claim this myself, this is an idea from one of our wonderful listeners, but let's take the Arab world's greatest gift to democracy, and that's the little pot of indelible ink. And when you turn up to the voting booth, to stick your finger in, and you know who's voted or not.
Yes, and with the with the declaration voting, and more votes are taking place prior to the actual election.
Yes.
Which I think is wrong. I think the election should be a reflection of the nation on one day. We should all go together, and that should be our vote.
And what about the issue, and this is also on your website, candu.org.au, on this issue. You say, when one name's crossed off on the roll in one polling station, what really should happen is it should be crossed off everywhere. Yeah. Why was it? Was it back in 83, wasn't it, under Hawke, that they decided that you don't have to have a designated polling booth? You can vote at any of the booths in your electorate, and therefore your name will be on all the rolls. Firstly, why was that change made? And secondly, what has been the result?
That was to make voting easier. Now, there was no complaint. Nobody was complaining.
Was it hard in the first place?
You just went to where you knew everybody knew where to go.
Yeah.
And it must have been done to increase the possibility of fraud, but I wouldn't definitely say that anybody I know was involved in doing that. But what other reason could you possibly have for doing that, and then not to do what is so simple to do? If we're going to vote anywhere we want to, then all of the polling stations should be joined by the internet. It'd be very simple then. When your name is crossed off in one polling booth, it's crossed off right across the Commonwealth. Mm. That'd be easy to do, as it is, say, with an ATM. Now, very easy to do, and we have mobile machines, and there's no reason why it can't be done, and vast amounts of money are thrown away on all sorts of other things. The only reason that it's not done must be that some people are misusing it. There must be a number of people who are misusing it. I'm hoping that in this election, the election will be so clear that it won't matter, but I'm hoping that the next government has plans to clean up the matter, because if we're going to be a democratic country, we're going to have close elections. They at least ought to be real elections which reflect the wishes of the Australian people.
Exactly.
The wishes of politicians.
Well, exactly. And of course, as one of the people who work here said, you know, we're such a democratic country that even the dead people get to vote. It's quite a nice little line. Now, we've covered so much ground. Unfortunately, I have to go because of time, and I've kept you up late enough as it is. Do you want to just give that book of yours that's coming out, what's that called?
The book is going to be Give Us Back Our Country.
Yes.
It's going to set out what's wrong, the way in which the power brokers and the elites have worked together to ensure that the Australian people don't have their agenda. They have another agenda which just doesn't pass the pub test. It's going to go back to the basic principles in the second part. And we're not taught anymore. The children particularly aren't taught anymore about what came to us from the Magna Carta, through the Glorious Revolution, through our wonderful federation movement. That is not taught
anymore. I was speaking to Kevin Donnelly about that last week on an interview to do with the history curriculum.
And then we're coming to what we propose the solution is. And the solution, I would not speak against new parties. They're very good, and reform parties are very good, and they do wonderful things. What we need, on top of our representative democracy, we need tools which make the politicians accountable, not every 3 or 4 years in confected elections, but on every day of every week of every month. And the way to do that is as in Switzerland. The way to do that is through the recall mechanism, through the citizen's veto, where by petition you can veto recently adopted legislation, such as a new tax, a carbon dioxide tax, which you were promised never to have.
Yes.
And the same with legislation you think should be in a place. For example, there ought to be legislation. We ought to have always had legislation that if you kick the door in, arriving on Christmas Island, coming from Indonesia, where you obviously got in as a tourist, and you arrive saying you don't have a passport, that should bar you from ever asking for asylum, because obviously something is wrong there. There ought to be some facility for citizens to bring in laws themselves. And what we're suggesting is, rather than this being done suddenly, that there should be an elected convention with delegates who are not paid, who should work out all of these principles and prepare a series of referendums for the Australian people to consider and decide whether they want to be like Switzerland, where the politicians
believe they have to learn from the people and don't try to force things down the people's necks. We shouldn't have situations we had the other day where the politicians suddenly announce that they're going to change
superannuation. Oh, but they're exempt. They're exempt.
Yes, oh, of course. Yeah,
of course. Oh. We couldn't have a constitutional challenge on that, they said. We'd better exempt ourselves.
And the ministers, the leading ministers, have...